Hello, friends, and welcome back to Ghouls Night In, the spooky chat show with your best ghoul friends. I'm Penny Snark.
And I'm Midge Munster. And today we're going to get pseudo-close to those crazy Victorians territory, but not in the way you would expect. I want to chat about the life of a man who was not a Victorian himself, but was obsessed with them, much as we are. he was not born in the Victorian era or lived through it, though. He was born in Depression era Chicago in February 1925, and this gentleman's name is Edward Gorey.
Oh, yay!
So if you don't know Edward Gorey, we're going to get into talking a lot about him today. I'm not even going to preface it. We're just going to jump in.
Let's do it.
So he was, in fact, obsessed with all things gothic and macabre, not just the Victorians, from nearly the beginning of his life. So Edward Gorey was an American writer, illustrator, designer, and much, much more than that. But before all that, he was a child prodigy.
I thought you were just going to say a child. And I was like, as were we all. I guess fewer of us were child prodigies.
What's worse? A child.
I'm so glad you know that. I had to explain that to someone the other day, and it's a difficult thing to explain.
No, I too am vine trash. Thank you so much. he was quite a prodigy. He had taught himself to draw by 18 months old.
And what?
Was like, yes, like actively drawing, not just like how kids draw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And was reading by age 3. He took immediate interest in gothic literature and had read Dracula by age 5.
Sir.
Frankenstein by 7. And by age 8 had read most of Victor Hugo's work.
This man's making us all of us goths look bad.
I know. What were we doing? What was I doing at 5? Watching TV? Learning the alphabet?
Embarrassing.
Embarrassing for us all. But as you can tell by that reading list, he had a distinct interest in gothic literature and things that were a bit ooky spooky. He just loved arts and culture in general. He made frequent trips to the theater and the ballet. He did spend a time after, like, around 18, he was drafted for World War II. So he spent a time in the service. But after he got out, he was, like, in the art. He attended Harvard from 1946 to 1950 and majored in French literature. Mm-hmm. And during that time, he cultivated a very eccentric social circle, including his roommate, who is a famous poet, Frank O'Hara, and others who have been referred to. The person who wrote kind of the definitive book on Edward Gorey calls this group the gay literati.
Ooh, hell yes.
Count like, me honestly, in. Yeah, work. So it is assumed by both people who met him during his life as well as now that most people think that Gorey himself was queer, but he never confirmed nor denied it. He very famously answered in interviews that he was, and I quote, a person first, an artist distant second, and whatever else last.
I respect that.
Yeah, he never put a label on it. However, it is very clear throughout his work that there is an undercurrent of gender fluidity and same-sex couples. Mm-hmm. So whether that reflected himself or his close friends, he was definitely a part of the community in some way. And he noted in a letter to a close friend that, as he called them, les boys were among the first to appreciate his unusual work.
The gays do be loving unusual work.
Yes, the gays, the theys, they loved the Gorey. Also, I don't really talk about it in my notes, but what a perfect name. Right? If I was born into the last name Gorey, you couldn't tell
you
me shit.
To. You gotta be a goth. Like it's just not optional at that point.
Well, that's why you're reading Dracula by 5. That's it's right in the name. So during his college years, this is when we see his first like documented Edward Gorey drawings. And his style becomes really solidified both as an artist and just as a human person. During his time at Harvard, he became known for keeping his large, luscious Edwardian style beard.
Yes.
He has this glorious kind of like curly mustache that goes into the beard. He started wearing long overcoats, usually made of fur, adorned with tons of jewelry and rings and things at all times. But he would wear this with like ripped up jeans and tennis shoes. Very bohemian, very sassy. Mm-hmm. Just a very like an interesting human to look at. So he yes. garnered a lot of attention anyway, outside of being artistically very gifted. But after college in 1952, he moved to New York, where he took a job at Doubleday's Anchor Books to be the designer of paper book covers. Notably, one of my favorite little tidbits here is that he did do the cover for T.S. Eliot's Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. Nice. That later, obviously, inspired the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical and the horrific film to follow.
We can't blame Gorey for any of that.
Gorey never would have let it happen.
No. I definitely had the Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats the Edward Gorey illustrations on it mm-hmm. when I was a kid.
And Cats become like not the musical. I think it's cute that this comes up now because Cats kind of become like a large part of Gorey's mm-hmm. life. So I love that even in this early state, we're seeing like love of critters. Yes. But in 1952, Pulp Fiction like inspired covers were very hot at that time. Like everything mm-hmm. was very specific looking and of a certain style. And so Gorey's style, which I guess I should say, if you've never seen an Edward Gorey illustration, he did pen and ink, like very black and white, stark, cross-hatched, like really detailed line work illustrations, mm-hmm. Almost like Burton-esque exaggeration of the human form, but like way before Burton was a person.
Mm-hmm. Burton does Gorey-esque exaggeration.
Exactly. But it made him stand out in what he was doing because it was very, very different from what was popular at the time. And while he was at Anchor, he also started making his first strides into publishing his own work. The first of which was The Unstrung Harp, which came out in 1953, which is just a year after he started working at Anchor.
Wow,
so
yeah.
Pretty impressive. If you've ever tried to get something published, it's not that easy. especially in this time, you couldn't indie publish things.
No kickstarting.
But The Unstrung Harp was set in kind of what becomes the familiar Victorian / Edwardian-esque neither world situation that Gorey tends to put most of his things in after this point. And it tells the tale of a gentleman named Mr. Earbrass and his tortured attempts to write a novel. But the book was in a much smaller format. It's most of Gorey's books you will find through this episode were very short.
Yes.
And it made them very difficult to categorize into a genre. They weren't really children's books, which is what most short form stories like that were, but they're not, and they're not really humor. So it kind of puts him in this weird gray area where it leads to a lot of indifference from mm-hmm. publishers and booksellers, and therefore bad sales. He's just not really picking up a lot of interest for what he's putting down at this moment. But nonetheless, his art style would continue to set him apart. And Gorey, even though his art was really what got him noticed, he still always depicted himself as a writer first, not an artist. And I love this. He categorized his works as Victorian novels all scrunched up.
Love that.
But he did really love writing. So he's in New York at Anchor Books. The move to New York did not initially excite him whatsoever. But this ended up being a time that was really influential to his work. Through his time in New York, he attended silent film evenings run by the film historian William K. Everson. And during those festivals, he discovered the work of French filmmaker Louis Fouillade. And this filmmaker made very like gothic crime thrillers, including Fantôme and Les Vampires, which I think some people will probably recognize Les Vampires. But that would become what Gorey would end up later referring to as the greatest influence on his work, period. That's his quote, on my work, period.
There you go.
So he was very, very influenced by this. He also became extremely passionate about the New York City Ballet and the choreographer, George, I hope I'm saying this right, Balanchine. Gorey attended every performance of Balanchine's ballets until the choreographer died in 1983. So he often referred to him as kind of his muse. He was very struck by what Balanchine was doing. Equally important in New York was the connection to Gotham Bookmark. Bookmark.
I can see where that would come from.
But Gorey becomes a close friend with the founder, Francis Steloff, and her successor, Andreas Braun. And Gotham Bookmart became the main place where Gorey's books were sold. Especially after, like later in the 60s, when he was able to establish his private imprint, the Fantôme Press, Gotham would like publish his books, give them a place to be sold. They also arranged for him to illustrate works by other very influential people. I was very excited. This was how he got the like gig of illustrating for Samuel Beckett, who is one of my absolute favorite playwrights. And the bookstore regularly also showed his work in the bookstore's art gallery as well. Including limited edition prints, which I want to take a pause here and tell a story that my friend Anne went and visited Edward Gorey's house last year. This didn't come up in any of my research. I reached out to her and I reached out to Matt Woods. And one of our friends is a big Gorey fan. And I was like, do you guys have any like tidbits that don't come up in all the like, you know,
the regulars.
And so Anne told me that the tour guide at the house told her that later in Gorey's life, when he started doing printmaking and selling his prints, it was because the company that he ordered his pins from stopped making the like exact pin nib that he had used his entire career, and that was what like helped him make his super thin lines and things, and he was never able to find a replacement that made it as enjoyable for him to draw. So he bought all the dead stock of that pen that he could find and kept drawing until he ran out, and then he just went into printmaking.
I'm not saying that's a neurodivergent thing to do, but
the way that when she told me this, I was like, one of us.
I was like, relatable.
Yeah, there's a few sweet little autism markers in here that I really enjoy. I had to stop and share that tidbit because I thought that was
Could those people get rid of his pen nib?
He's an incredible artist. He's an
icon. He needs that nib.
You've stopped him in the prime of his career. But back to his work during the time of the pen nibs.
In the halcyon days of the pen nib.
In 1963, he published his, what I would say is his most recognizable work, The Gashly Crumb Tinies.
Yes.
This is what I would guess that most of you listening who have a general knowledge of Edward Gorey probably know him from. Or even if you didn't know it was Edward Gorey, you might have knowledge of The Gashly Crumb Tinies. But if you don't, this is an alphabet book that is very silly goofy. I own a copy of this book. I love it so much. But it is it's an alphabet book with 26 Victorian children, each with a first name that corresponds to a letter of the alphabet. And you go through and find out how each of them dies. They all meet some kind of weird, untimely end in kind of like mundane ways, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not like dramatic per se, which I think is what makes it so funny.
It's very matter of fact.
It's what?
It's very matter of fact. That's just like, there you go. Like,
we have falling down the stairs, mm-hmm. choking on a peach pit. We have a kid that dies of ennui.
I was going to say, this is the book that I first learned the term ennui from.
I need you to know that when I was originally trying to figure out how to open this episode, I was going to just do like, M is for Midge, who died. Like, and I specifically picked P is for Penny, who died of ennui, was going to be yours. Because I was like, that would be how Penny would go.
It is. It's true. It's true. I can't deny it.
But this, it's funny. And I know it's not funny to some people, but it's funny. And it does what Gorey's work did, which was like kind of poke fun at the darkness. Like, I think especially that book in particular kind of messes, like, jokes about the anxieties of like being a parent and all the like mm-hmm. crazy silly things that could like quote go wrong, especially when you're looking at a Victorian era, like murder bottles, like things that just people were just trying to live their life and feed their kids, and death was everywhere. But for what are probably very obvious reasons, this book was not super liked at the time. And honestly, probably still not liked by a lot of people now. It's just been forgotten about by a lot of people. But this, like I said, this was kind of the goal of Gorey's art. The universe that he created was full of these like upsetting situations and beasts and victims that were often children. And he didn't ever explain himself to anyone. He wasn't offering meaning about his work other than there is a quote of him saying, "My mission in life is to make everybody as uneasy as possible because that is what the world is like."
Yeah.
Period. And for that reason, unfortunately, his written work stayed fairly in the shadows for his early years. But he did experience quite a bit of fame in the 70s. He gets kind of catapulted into the public eye, firstly by Andreas Braun, who we spoke about, the proprietor of the mm-hmm. Gotham Book Mart. She persuaded him to release an anthology of his hard-to-find early titles, and that resulting Amphigory is what it's called, 1972, was produced in such a format that it actually like suited conventional bookstore selling, and it became an instant bestseller. So he's getting some attention from that. Then soon after, in 1973, a production of Dracula that he had designed for a small theater in Nantucket, that garnered enough attention that in 1977 it was put up on Broadway as Edward Gorey's Dracula.
What a dream.
This was a huge success. It ran for almost 3 years, toured internationally. Let me tell you all right now. Let me tell you something. So first of all, Gorey designed everything for this production. Sets, playbills, costumes, the whole shebang. As a theater girly at heart, this is my shit. Like, we'll have to post some photos specifically. Like, well, obviously I'm sure the like cover photo we share will be of his like books and stuff, but I am going to request Penny of us now that we put up a photo of this GD Dracula set. This is my Roman Empire. It is so beautiful because it's done in his like crosshatch tiny fine line style, but blown up to theater scale. And it's so freaking cool. I can't get over it. And that no one else could get over it either. The designs were like really highly acclaimed. And he won a Tony Award in 1978 for costume design of Dracula. But in true gory fashion, he sent a friend to pick it up because he was at the ballet.
The man's got to get to the ballet.
He couldn't be bothered. Now, I know, much like I was, you might be thinking, what? He didn't want to accept his Tony Award for this really amazing thing? But as a rule, Gorey did not want to be in the public eye. He was not after fame. And so in 1979, he takes all the royalties from Dracula and purchased a 200-year-old sea captain's house in Yarmouthport, I'm sure. Massachusetts always has a way of saying things.
Right.
But it's in Cape Cod. And that's his home for the rest of his life. He kind of goes back into reclusivity and just draws with what pens he has left. But he creates like his castle. It is filled to the brim with a collection of more than 20,000 books. He was a just like vicious reader, loved to read. It's also like just a little Niffler goth's fantasy. He has like rocks and flea market finds and weird little bits of iron and just like anything and everything, along with a carefully selected collection of famous paintings and things. He was just living his like little spooky bohemian life out in Cape Cod. The dream.
I too would like to go into reclusion at my sea captain's house full of cool shit.
Right? I was like, living, like, that's the dream. Make your money and then go hide away in your like little hut. Yes.
My little goth nest.
My goth cottage. And of course, the other thing he had in this house, like we slightly mentioned earlier, was many, many cats.
Cats!
He becomes a crazy cat guy, and we love him for it. He was notorious for having up to 6 cats at a time, as well as raccoons that lived in the house when he got there and like refused to evict them. He let them like kind of take over parts of the house until they eventually settled like up in the attic, and he was like, cool, they live there.
Sure.
He was just a real animal guy. He was lifelong lover of animals, and in his will he left his entire estate to the care and welfare of animals.
Oh,
very nice. So today his estate proceeds, they go to all kinds of creature protections, whales and bats, and of course cats. After his death in 2000 at age 75, his Cape Cod home became a Edward Gorey House Museum, and the profits from that program also benefit animal rights as well as literacy programs. Very cool.
Very cool.
So, Gorey's art career obviously involved a great range of mediums, from his books to theater to being a fashion icon. His creative expression was just kind of limitless. And we honestly really only scratched the surface here today. I had to kind of pick and choose what we really focused on, because there was so much to his life and his work. But it's obviously his style is instantly recognizable, and it continues to inspire a lot of the modern macabre creatives of today.
Oh yeah.
Like we said before, Tim Burton obviously takes heavy like from Edward Gorey. However, also, here's the thing. Y'all know that I have a very complicated relationship with Mr. Burton. I love his work so much, but I know he's kind of a prick. And he has been very like adamant that he does not take inspiration from Edward Gorey. And everyone's like, okay.
We have eyes though.
Yeah, Timmy, we see what's going on. But many other creatives have loudly taken their claim of their inspiration of his work, mm-hmm. Including Neil Gaiman, my childhood favorite, Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket.
Yes.
Just talked very, very heavily about Gorey's work. And Guillermo del Toro has been very forthcoming in his admiration as well, and calls Ghoul's Night Inn favorite Crimson Peak his, quote, bloodstained Valentine to Gorey.
Oh, love that.
So honestly, before this episode, I did not know a ton about Edward Gorey. I knew like enough to be dangerous, but mm-hmm. I had never really delved much into his life. And it was really fun to just go back and see how many pieces of things that I love now or that I loved as a kid were inspired by his work. Mm-hmm. It was really cool to like get to put the little puzzle pieces together. And he was obviously a very, very cool person, a very spirited person, a very like interesting, free, artistic soul. I wish that he were still with us so I could meet him. But I really hope to eventually get to go out sometime next time I'm in Massachusetts, maybe, and go see his home and his museum now that I have some more respect for his work and what he did. I hope that you all enjoyed learning about him as well. If you have been to the Edward Gorey house or have some fun Edward Gorey factoids, please let me know. Oh, I also, Matt Woods did mention, I thought this was very cool. This was his one of his little factoids he told me that he learned on a tour. Apparently Edward Gorey like worked in scale, like his, the size that art is published in the books is the size he did them at.
Oh, wow.
Which, if you've held an Edward Gorey book, they're very small.
They're little. It's
very, very tiny. And there's lots of little lines. So that's pretty astounding that he was that like detail oriented and able to do it at that scale.
I'm going to have to pick up my Gashly Crumb Tinies and take a look.
Mine actually is on like, I have a little like book nook at the top of my desk so I can like see it right now. And I'm like, oh, I want to just grab it and look at it. But that is all for today. Thank you all so much for listening. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, it would mean so much to us if you would consider leaving us a rating or a review wherever you listen. You can leave those on Apple Podcasts. You can leave a Spotify comment, or you can always send it to us in an Instagram message if you can't leave reviews where you listen to us. But Penny has something to share with us today. I don't remember what.
I do. I have a Spotify comment. So for any of our Spotify listeners, you are able to comment on episodes. And this one is on our Ghoulywed game episode from Nick C, who says, absolutely love this episode. I've loved all of them, but the Q&As and Wrapped are particular favorites. This is the first and only podcast I listen to, and I couldn't enjoy more. So thank you, Nick. Thank you for coming into the podcast world just to hang out with us.
Just for us. You're so sweet. I'm glad we can enrapture you with our stupidity.
We do our best. We keep the fun coming.
Well, if you are looking for more from this podcast, you can always give us a follow on Instagram. We are at Ghouls Night In Pod. And if you're looking for me, you can find me all over the web at Midge Munster.
And you can find me at Penny Snark.
And until next time,
goodbye.